for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For the past 2 years, a team of journalists at the Washington Post has been combing through property records, government documents and contracts, and social networking sites. They've conducted hundreds of interviews with intelligence, military, and corporate officials. The results of their investigation have been featured on the newspaper's front pages since Monday. The three-part series is called Top Secret America, and it's causing controversy in the intelligence community. Joining me in the studio is reporter William Arkin. Dana Priest is on her way to the studio. Later in the hour, we'll talk with the first director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte. In the meantime, we invite your calls. Many of you, I'm sure, have already read the series. For those of you who haven't, joined us with your questions, your comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Bill Arkin, good morning to you.
It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. For the past 2 years, you've spent, what, literally 18 hours a day?
We have. We started this process in August of 2008. Dana and I are both veteran national security reporters and investigators. We got together and we were having a discussion about something that we both thought was odd that we were looking at. And the end result of it was that we realized we were both looking at the same thing, a kind of growth of government that had occurred after 9/11, a shift in the balance of power between government and the private sector, a huge superstructure which had been built in the Washington area that seemed to be either above or below what we'd think of as normal government. And we said to ourselves, how could we possibly penetrate this to describe it in some way for the American public as to what has happened a decade after 9/11? And that's what we tried to do.
What has thus far been the reaction to the series?
Well, I think the reaction has been puzzling, befuddling, and very gratifying. This is an issue that touches the hearts of many people, Republican and Democrat alike. It's about government spending. It's about Washington. It's about efficiency of the government. It's about too much government. It's about not enough government. There's a little bit of candy here for everyone. So I have been surprised at the degree to which, on the one hand, the government provided us with enormous assistance in terms of making people available for us on the record. Secretary of Defense Gates, CIA Director Leon Panetta are quoted in the story directly. And then on top of it, you know, you can really see in the process with which our reporting unfolded the bifurcations inside government, which is to say that the security people did what the security people do and went on red alert, while the policy people basically agreed with us and said this is a serious problem that we need to address.
Bill, tell me what the major findings of your investigative reporting have been.
Well, I would say there are three things, Diane. One is that an ad hoc surge within the government that began right after 9/11, the creation of new institutions and the surge in the size of the counterterrorism structure never went away and, in fact, is now digging in for its own bureaucratic permanency. So the nature of government itself has changed, and we've tracked 283 new government organizations that have been created since 9/11 in the counterterrorism world. The second thing I would say is that we have watched the world, not just the world of defense, but the entire world, transform from a hardware society to an information technology society. And this has affected defense as much as it affects anybody. And so we see not only the shift in emphasis from producing weapons to producing information, but we also see a shift in how that's done. And that leads to the third conclusion, which is the role of the private sector in all of this. Not only were private corporations called into this war on terror because there needed to be a quick surge and they were more efficient and quicker than the federal government, but the private sector has now become more or less a third of the overall counterterrorism efforts of the United States government. And the involvement of the private sector in matters of national security just raises so many profound questions about government and about democracy that we're just, I think, laying the foundation for a much larger debate.
William Arkin, he's national security reporter for The Washington Post. He is an author, researcher, and military expert. One of the issues that you talk about is the explosion in size of the entire U.S. intelligence system since the September 11th attacks. You talk about the growth in the private sector and especially contractors. You say that 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget is spent on private contractors. The Office of the Director of Intelligence has talked back and said that your statement is a myth and that the reality is, I quote, "This is a repeated misconception. 70% of the intelligence community budget is spent on contracts, not contractors. Those contracts cover major acquisitions such as satellites, computer systems, as well as commercial activities like rent, food services, facilities." How do you respond to that?
Well, it's one of those classic government non-denial denials. I mean, they're calling them contracts and we're calling them contracts, and we just are using exactly the same numbers and exactly the same description. I think the point that the Directorate of National Intelligence was trying to make was that this is not all services contracts, and we never say that in our article. We merely say that 70% of the dollar goes to the private sector, and to say that that's always been the case is not accurate historically. There was a day when the U.S. government, people who were officers of the U.S. government, who wore the uniform of the U.S. government, who worked in government plants, produced the majority of the weaponry that was necessary for us to wage the Cold War. That's not the case today. And so this movement, whether or not they're producing a satellite or they're producing a PowerPoint briefing, to me doesn't really matter. It's not impugning them. It's merely asking the question as to whether or not we want to place matters of national security so firmly in the hands of organizations whose primary objective is profit.
How many private contractors did you find at work within the intelligence community?
Well, to our astonishment, there are 1,931 companies that do work at the top secret level. Diane, if we were trying to count the companies that worked at the secret level, the number would be over 10,000.
And all these people then have top secret security clearance.
Within each of those companies, whether it's a company that provides security, whether it's a company that's actually building the optics for the satellite, or whether it's a company that's providing the IT geeks for the command centers, there are cadres of people who are granted top secret clearances and, of course, all the compartmented clearances that go with it. And we have calculated that out of the 850,000 Americans who have top secret clearances actively today, about a third of them work for the private sector.
That 850,000 figure, I'm interested in whether you know what that figure was on 9/11.
No, we really don't. And it's an interesting question as well, because it's to some degree comparing apples to oranges. During the Cold War, the military was 4 or 5 times the size that it is today. And the amount of people that were required to man the systems was so much greater. But as the information technology age has taken over, the number of soldiers, the number of technicians, the number of people that are needed to do something, to get a drone flying from somewhere in the Middle East to over Pakistan, to look at the video, to process it, to bring it back to command centers in the U.S. and make decisions, has declined so significantly. I mean, come on. We all remember the day when we used to go to an ATM machine in the 1970s, put our card in, and pray that cash was going to come out. I mean, this is technology that's only 20 or 30 years old, and the information technology is only a decade old. So to compare it pre-9/11 is really hard in numbers, but there's no doubt that the emphasis of this community has shifted from hardware to information.
William Arkin, national security reporter for the Washington Post. He and Dana Priest have, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, have written a series which third portion appears on the front pages of the Washington Post today. Dana Priest will join us in just a moment. And we'll take your call. Stay with us. And we're back. William Arkin is in the studio. We're talking about the series that he has done with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Dana Priest, titled Top Secret America. The piece has been featured each morning in the Washington Post, the third in the series. Is on the front pages today. I'd like to go back to the communication sent to you by the Director of Intelligence. They state as myth that the intelligence community does not have an accurate picture of its contractor ranks and does not exercise proper oversight over that community. In reality, they say, the IC is a leader in taking a serious, systematic approach in planning and managing its core contract personnel. Bill Arkin, how do you respond?
Well, when I saw the statement from David Gompert, the acting director of National Intelligence, saying that this is not the intelligence community we recognize, a friend of mine in the Pentagon quipped, "I think that's the point of your article," which is to say that it isn't the intelligence community that they recognize, because the Directorate of National Intelligence is only one piece of this pie. And in the Department of Homeland Security and in the Department of Defense and in the civil agencies and in the law enforcement agencies who have all gotten involved in counterterrorism are pieces of the government and pieces of the pie that the intelligence community no longer controls, if they ever controlled. And as we saw yesterday in General Clapper's hearing to be the next director of national intelligence, everyone accepts at this point the proposition that the director of national intelligence is a position that is in need of reform, and that there is a requirement overall for there to be either a director of national intelligence that's truly a director of national intelligence, or on the other hand, that we need to get rid of this office altogether.
Here's the first email from Paul, who says the Washington Post article seems so far to focus on the effectiveness and efficiency of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. An equally important but unexamined issue is whether the American people can trust the fundamental truthfulness of the intelligence apparatus. Prior to the invasion of Iraq, the intelligence apparatus actively participated in perpetuating a fraud to create a consensus that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Why should the American people trust the intelligence apparatus, even if it were efficient? And joining us now in the studio is co-author of the series, Dana Priest, national intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. Dana is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you, Diane.
How do you address that emailer's concerns?
Well, I love that question because it goes to the sort of the fundamental mistrust the American people have always had in government. It's just part of who we are. And it speaks to the role of the media. You know, one of the reasons we get special protection under the Constitution is because we're supposed to be the person that throws the rocks at the window and says, are you sure? Are you sure? In this area, you know, he's talking about the buildup to Iraq and whether or not the media, in a sense, did a good enough job as well looking at that. And I say you can't even try to do that unless you do something which is controversial, which is you go into a classified, you go into a realm that is by its nature classified. All that information that they were keeping about the war and about weapons of mass destruction was classified. So it required that reporters go into that world and try to do their job despite that in a responsible manner.
Of course, though you call the series Top Secret America, you got all of your information from non-secret documents, Bill.
Well, I think that's right. The label Top Secret America is to suggest this alternate geography which has been established all through the United States since 9/11. The growth of government, the transformation of the industry, it's spread throughout the United States. So the Top Secret America is not to say that this is a classification level of our story. The reality was that we kind of pondered in the summer of 2008, how are we going to do this? And we both hit upon the idea at the same time that everything that happens, happens somewhere. So if you're talking about torture, if you're talking about warrantless surveillance, if you're talking about counterterrorism, if you're talking about drones, it all has to happen someplace. And so we set about, from the smallest pieces of information, to try to characterize what this looked like by going first to the addresses and the locations.
So where did you go?
Well, we've put together hundreds of thousands of small pieces of information, most of it from the government directly, property records and contracts and government descriptions of organizations, functions manuals. I mean, I am one of the most well-known people in the world for reading all these boring documents, and I can tell you that, you know, slowly ever so slowly, we began to build a picture. I remember having a conversation with Dana in November 2008 saying, we're up to 200 companies that do this work.
Well, that's where I wanted to jump in, Dana. There's so much overlap, so many layers. Is it an efficiently operating intelligence system?
Well, we don't think so, and that's why the Bill's number of 200 is relevant, because it actually grew to 2,000, and then when we started saying, well, what do they actually do? Then that's where you find the overlap. So one of the things that we did is, after we got a better sense of how many, and we did go out, we did a lot of gumshoe, just traditional journalism, walking the streets of where these were and looking around and then coming back and finding more and asking more people. You know, we had sources along the way that helped point us in certain directions. But then we asked that question, which is, okay, we have the size, okay, so that's one part, but what does that tell us? And then if you overlay on the size what each of these companies do, or what each of the agencies do, then that's where you start seeing the redundancy. And you can go online in our database and look at it yourself, because we had some great young designers working with us who then took the raw data and said, well, how do we show it to people in a meaningful way? And so we have this wonderful, it looks like a rainbow color wheel that you can move around agency to agency, and you can see how many agencies do, for instance, tracking the flow of money from terrorist organizations in and out. And you can see that there are 41 agencies that do that. And so we would take
that. Are they talking to each other?
What we did as reporters then is we would take lists of these organizations, and we would go to some of them and say, do you know that this other guy is doing this? And often they said, oh, that's really interesting, we didn't know that. And then we'd vet that somewhere else. And pretty soon we got this picture that, oh gosh, you know, this is a little uncomfortable. They don't even know as much as we do about some of the things that are going on within the government. To me, that was the most shocking part of the investigation, is that people within the government kept saying, you know, oh, could I look at that? You know, they didn't have the say, because they're not set up to look across the departments. They're stovepiped in a way.
But that's what we were told right at the beginning, right after 9/11, when this Office of Intelligence, National Intelligence, was created. His role purportedly was to be the person overseeing and coordinating CIA, National Intelligence, FBI, bring it all together so that there wouldn't be any of this overlapping or redundancy. What you're saying is that it has grown exponentially.
Well, and also Congress, who created the DNI, the director, Congress did not give that person the authority to do exactly what you described. So what they did was they set up a title, gave him some authority to do some things, but not the authority to do what you just mentioned. He can use his personality to try to cajole people into sharing information. And in fact, they've made progress in sharing information, but the system has grown so big it's overwhelmed some of that progress.
And now, joining us by phone from Switzerland is Ambassador John Negroponte. He was the first Director of National Intelligence, serving from 2005 to 2007. Good morning to you, sir. I'm pleased to have you with us.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
You have said that you believe the Washington Post series misses the forest by looking at lots of trees. What do you mean?
Well, first of all, I mean, I commend the authors. I think they've done a really interesting work, and I know they've put an awful lot of effort into it. But I do think it is a bit of a bottom-up approach rather than looking at this thing from the top down. And from where I sat, I think we sought to deal, and with a measure of success did deal, with a number of the problems that have been mentioned. Certainly, information sharing across the community, the horizontal movement of information, the better use of information technology, all of that, I think, is very much in progress. And I think that the result is that we continue to have the best intelligence set up in the world, and I think it it continues to improve.
One question that I and an awful lot of people have had is, how much power did you have then? How much power does the Director of National Intelligence have now?
Yeah, I mean, I've said on record that he probably didn't have enough and probably doesn't have enough. The legislation was the product of compromise, and there were people all along the spectrum. There were people who didn't want any reform at all. They wanted the CIA director to retain his position as director of Central Intelligence, all the way to those who wanted to make the new director of National Intelligence a cabinet officer or a cabinet department. So it ended up being a compromise. But I would say this, certainly had convening power, certainly had the president's ear, and had quite a lot of authority in the area of formulating and proposing budgets. But could the DNI function be more powerful, more authoritative? I certainly think in the budgetary area that would be a good thing.
Of course, even Defense Secretary Gates and CIA Director Leon Panetta said a number of the concerns brought up in the series are valid. Secretary Gates says there's been so much growth since 9/11 that getting your arms around that, not just for the CIA, but the Secretary of Defense, is a challenge.
But in a way, those remarks prove the point that you need a DNI. You need a cabinet-level official, which the DNI position is, who spends all his time thinking about how to make the intelligence community better. Mr. Gates has other responsibilities. The director of the CIA runs his agency day to day. The DNI job is not an operational job in that sense. It's more, I would like to think of it as the manager of the intelligence community.
But then the question becomes, how do you manage something as wide, as broad, and as deep as 850,000 people with top-secret clearances?
Well, here's why I mentioned the top-down versus the bottom-up. If you look at all 840,000 or so who may have clearances, and a lot of them, by the way, the articles themselves point out are information technology experts. But if you look at it from the top down, there are really only six key agencies here. There's the DIA, there's the CIA, there's the National Geospatial Agency, there's the National Reconnaissance Office, there's the Department of Homeland Security, and there's the FBI. And we, during my tenure, we formed an executive committee, and we met on a very regular basis to go over issues of common interest and concern. And if you take those six agencies, rather than looking at the myriad organizations that may have a little piece of the intelligence portfolio, you really have got the lion's share of our national intelligence effort.
It's interesting that CIA Director Leon Panetta told the Washington Post that he has begun mapping out a five-year plan for his agency because the levels of spending since 9/11 are not sustainable.
Well, what I would say to that is that, of course, a lot of that spending is because they've gone very operational since 9/11. They've been engaged directly in paramilitary and related types of operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and those are covered usually in the big supplementals that we pass every fall. And, of course, that's run up their budget dramatically. Once we lower our profile in those situations, eventually get out of Iraq in the next year or two, and eventually out of Afghanistan, those kind of demands and budgetary costs are headed for a decline.
What is the budget, or what was the budget of the Office of National Intelligence when you took it on?
What we call the national intelligence budget was somewhere in the vicinity of $40 to $45 billion. And I would point out that, you know, since a lot of it is within the Defense Department appropriation, that's less than 10% of our overall defense spending. So I think as a national strategic matter, you got to ask yourself, well, is 10% of your defense budget worth spending on intelligence that could help thwart or avert some serious attack against our country?
Ambassador John Negroponte, he was the first Director of National Intelligence. Thanks for joining us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The July Reader's Review. A middle-aged financial journalist teams up with a troubled young computer hacker in the mystery thriller topping this summer's bestseller list, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Dana Priest and William Arkin of The Washington Post are with me. We're talking about their series, Top Secret America, which has appeared on the front page of The Washington Post all of this week. And you just heard the voice of Ambassador John Negroponte. He served as the first Director of National Intelligence from 2005 to 2007. He said that when he took on the job, his budget was $45 billion. What is it now, Dana, for the Office of National Intelligence?
Well, the overall figure that they actually talk about publicly is $75 billion, so that's 2.5 times. But that doesn't include a whole lot of military programs, military-related programs. It probably pushes it up to around the $100 billion mark.
$100 billion. And so is that more than the percentage Ambassador Negroponte outlined, Bill?
Well, my guess is that if you combine all of the elements of the formal intelligence community, the 16 agencies, so it's funny now here that we have the former director of national intelligence essentially impugning 10 of them by ignoring them, Secondly, if you include the apparatus of the Department of Homeland Security, which has been created since 9/11, if you include the law enforcement community and its significant role in counterterrorism, you know, I think that you can't in any way calculate what the actual cost is to the American public. And I really felt embarrassed about that for a long time until I talked to so many people in the government who said, we don't know either. I mean, it's one thing to say we know where the appropriations are. It's another thing to say, do we really know where the spending is going? And those are slightly two different things. And so, yes, you can say that there's a top-level intelligence spending budget, but it doesn't include billions of dollars in the DHS. It doesn't include billions of dollars in other agencies. It doesn't include the Department of Energy. It doesn't include this and that. And as Ambassador Negroponte says, it doesn't include all the supplementals and all of the special organizations that he seems to want to dismiss.
All right. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First, a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Yes. I just starting from the beginning, Diane, you'd asked about the 70% number that the author brought out that said private contractors.
Right.
Of the intelligence community.
Right.
And he responded back saying that that in the past that you brought out the satellites and all this stuff, this big equipment that the government said this includes a lot of things, a lot of hardware, et cetera. And I guess my concern with an article like this, and it goes back to what Ambassador Negroponte said, is that it's kind of a bottom up approach. The author is throwing out this big 70% number saying, oh, my God, look how bad this is. But in reality, a ton of this stuff is big, expensive hardware. And his response to that was, well, two things was that, and I'm not a big fan of the government by any means. That's not my point here. I'm not a government worker or anything along those lines. But to be fair, his response was a denial, the government's denial, whatever that little quip he made. And then he went on to say, well, in the past, a lot of the times, the stuff was made in government factories. And that was a long time ago, one. And if you think about it, government factories, what does that bring to mind? It brings to mind the former Soviet Union. I worked in the former Soviet Union when they started privatizing all this stuff. All that stuff was junk. The private sector has a role here. If you want to...
Now, hold on a minute, Chris. Tell me what your actual question is.
Well, my question is what actual percentage, what actual numbers is for all these new employees that are being brought on?
All right. Dana.
Okay. Well, first of all, just to go back to the 70%, actually,
yeah.
We didn't use the 70% in our stories. The government office put that fact sheet out with the myths and the facts, but none of the myths are in our stories. So I don't know exactly if it's 70%. But the other point is, you can't really judge this by a percentage of this or a percentage of that. What we did is to just try to build a portrait of how big it was and then to find the patterns and then to look at those patterns. So, you know, we could spend hours debating every little factoid in it, but the general drift is they don't really know what they're getting for their money. And that's the point of the money. It's not,
how much it is.
It's what we're doing with
it. Okay, Bill.
Well, again, I understand how Ambassador Negroponte the Great doesn't like the bottom-up approach, but the bottom-up approach is the way in which we were able to put data to this idea. And we went both directions. It's silly. We have actually, in the last 2 years, I think, talked to the heads of a half dozen of these agencies, the directors themselves. We have had sources throughout the government. So we've been dealing with the top level as well. But the reality is, to put a picture together, we had to start at the bottom up. And here's what the numbers show you, Diane. It's so clear. Of the 1,271 government organizations of all kinds that do top secret work in America, 283 of them were founded since 9/11. And the second thing I would say is, of the contractors that exist, the 1,931 contractors that do top secret work in America, a quarter of every one of those companies was founded since 2002.
Here's an email from Lurie, who says the U.S. government has already outsourced the work of the Army and Special Forces to groups like Blackwater. Do you see this outsourcing of intelligence collection and analysis as related to that, Bill or Dana?
Well, yes, it's related in the sense of why are they outsourcing? I mean, part of the reason is because they rightly believe that you could hire more people quickly if you went to the private sector, which is true because the process here is slow. But the second reason is that after 9/11, when they decided they needed to grow their capability quickly, they did it in a way that and this is Congress. This isn't Congress with the president's urging. They said, we'll give you tens of billions of dollars in extra money, but you cannot use it to hire federal employees. You have to use it to hire people outside. So they purposely made this money available in part because it's politically risky to say you're growing the size of the government. So they could tell us that they hadn't grown the number of actual federal employees. Meanwhile, they were growing this whole other thing that wasn't being counted, but turned into, and I think I'll give everybody the benefit of the doubt, they wanted to make a system bigger, quicker. And private contractors certainly contribute a lot of very good things, but the size and where the money's going has gotten out of control. And those workers, the contractors are doing, most of the time, they're doing things that the government could do. In other words, they're replicating what the government did. And even the heads of these agencies, including CIA Director Panetta, said in an interview, I feel like I have less control over contractors than I do direct personnel, so I would like to take our operational work at least and move that back into the
interesting agency. All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'd like to thank the authors for an excellent article. I think it's getting a lot of attention that it deserves, and I would also suggest that people who are interested in this topic also take a look at Jeremy Scahill's and Tim Schrock's work. But I think there's a lot of argument over the, there's so much detail in the series, and I haven't read it all, obviously, but there's a lot of argument over what facts are correct and not all that much context. Is the 70% figure correct, that type of thing. But I wonder, what does it mean? Because what we see is this gigantic sort of secret, out-of-control government agency, and much of its resources are directed towards scooping up internal information. It's totally unclear whether or not it actually keeps us any safer, because there's just so much that there's an inability to analyze it. And, we have government agencies that don't want to be monitored. The Intelligence Authorization Act is up, and it had some strong provisions in it to allow oversight. And Obama threatened a veto if the Intelligence Authorization Act contained those provisions, so they've been stripped out. So we're just supposed to be happy about the fact, since it falls under the rubric of keeping us safe, that we have this secret government that's keeping tabs on everybody.
And that's the question so many people have. Are we any safer because of this huge growth in the size of the intelligence community?
Well, we don't have a total, conclusion on that, but what we do is we have people at higher levels who say you can't really tell. But, the caller's point was really also about congressional oversight, and unlike any other area in government, this area relies on Congress to oversee it, because we on the outside can only go so far because it is all classified. And he's right that the Obama administration has taken a very awkward view for, open government words. They've not only said that they don't agree with the provisions to give Congress more oversight, but they've also said they do not agree that the Congressional Accountability Office, which monitors so much of government and does audits, investigations of every other department, they say they do not want them to be looking at the intelligence community. And that is sort of unexplainable just on a good government basis.
Bill.
Well, the caller also, I think, asks the great question about what is the context here? And believe me, the Washington Post did not indulge us working on this for 2 years to come up with conventional wisdom. So one of the things that we really tried to struggle with was, what's new here? What's different? What does it really mean? And I think that we can refer to the ambassador's remarks again in terms of that happy talk about government helping and doing better and reforming, and then looking at the reality. And to me, the reality is that as he says that we're going to get out of Iraq and get out of Afghanistan and all of this is going to go away, well, one of the things we did in the first story was we explained everyone's building new buildings. They're digging in. They're not planning to go away. These ad hoc organizations are becoming permanent. They have buildings, giant new buildings, 33 new buildings in the Washington area alone. And then the second thing that we discovered that really, I think, was against conventional wisdom was that 30% of everyone doing this work works in the private sector. It doesn't impugn the private sector. It just raises enormous questions about whether or not the private sector is the place to do it and whether they have any incentive to cooperate.
William Morgan and Dana Priest, co-authors of Top Secret America, a series running this week in the Washington Post, which can be read online at
WashingtonPost.com/TopSecretAmerica.
All right. Or just TopSecretAmerica.com.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Bedford, Ohio. Good morning, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dana, I believe it's Dana and William.
Yes.
I just wanted to congratulate you on having Ambassador John Negroponte actually come on, because I think really he gives credence to possibly something, a larger issue, or maybe a larger concern that maybe you haven't voiced, or maybe, but you may have asked your questions, yourself a question about this, that that really you've only drawn a picture of something that's already been painted, that somebody knows that these organizations exist, even though there may be overlap, even though there may be they may be denying or don't know what the about the other institution that do the same things, all the overlap, that, but somebody knows. I mean, has that been a question you've asked yourself, or in maybe in a series, because I haven't read it yet, I only heard about it, is that something maybe you've asked yourself, whether or not that is a possibility, that that even though in your piece you're sounding like it's all disparate but even connected, but maybe there is a larger connection behind them?
Well, we ask people that all the time. I'm trying to figure out how to get information. We, you know, tried to find people who had an overview, and we just couldn't. And usually you can. You know, usually when you're putting together something on a big system, there you can find the people within the government that have the real numbers. You can find them in the Office of Management and Budget or particular staffs, but we really couldn't. In fact, people said the opposite. You know, I just can't help you because we don't have the numbers on that.
Now, yesterday, the confirmation hearings began for retired Air Force General James Clapper. He's going to be, if confirmed, the next National Intelligence Director. Does the job have power? If it doesn't have a whole lot of power, why would Clapper take it, Bill?
Well, first of all, he didn't take that job or didn't take the offer to get that job unless the president promised him a lot more power than that office currently has. That's
well,
the way Washington
that
works.
Wouldn't that imply a huge effort at reorganization?
It would imply that. But I think more importantly, the question is whether or not he is going to actually be elevated from manager to a secretary, elevated to that real cabinet status that comes with that. And I think that the use of the word manager in itself by Ambassador Negroponte is just says volumes about the limitations. So, and also let's remember, James Clapper is currently the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. That would make him the most powerful man in the intelligence community because he controls most of the programs. He's now being elevated to a job that, by legislation and inherently, has less power. So clearly, we are going to see a very interesting transformation take place over the next months if he takes office.
Dana?
You know, I guess I would disagree, and we have disagreements here. I would be surprised if they gave the spot more actual power. First, Congress would need to do that. And also, the position still is so controversial, and even the Defense Department doesn't want it to have more power. So I think he'll have a better relationship and maybe cajole people into doing more things.
Dana Priest and William Arkin, they are co-authors of Top Secret America for The Washington Post. It's appearing this morning, is the third segment, the final segment. You can read it online at WashingtonPost.com or simply Top Secret America. Congratulations on your pieces.
Thank you.
Thanks
very much
for
Diane.
Being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.